Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Welcome all. Over two seasons, I'm a Killer has been binged by audiences around the world. Hailed by critics as true crime at its most brutal, captivating and unsettling, I'm a Killer gives those serving life sentences the opportunity to tell their story face to face and from their own perspective, while interviews with detectives, the victims and their families allow viewers to see both sides. It's impossible to watch without your opinions constantly changing during the course of each episode. My name's Sam Pearson, producer of several crime investigation podcasts, and I'm very pleased that we're joined here today at CrimeCon by those who made the show. Here we have Transistor Films' Danny Tipping, Ned Parker and Zoe Hines to discuss how they tell compelling yet balanced true crime stories. Firstly, though, how did the idea for I Am a Killer come about?
We started developing the series about 4 years ago. We'd made several true crime series for CNI and various other networks, and we were working out what could we do next. What could we do next that moves on the genre and keeps it interesting for us? And one of the things we hadn't done or hadn't explored was the voice of the last person to see the victim alive, the killer, the one person that could probably tell us. Not what happened, but why it happened. And then we started quite naively at first thinking, well, we'll just go and interview people on death row. Why doesn't everybody do that? And then we found out. It's a very, very long process of letter writing and communication with the prison services and the inmates and building up trust from both the facilities and the killers for them to be able to share their stories. And so We did that first. We developed those relationships and built up a pile of stories, basically, that we could then pitch to broadcasters. So we started talking to a number of broadcasters, and it took 6, 8 months, 10 months to start getting people interested, and it just wasn't happening. And as is often the case with TV series, they're a long time in the making, and this or even more so with the lengthy, protracted letter writing process from the prisons. And we could send a letter off to a prison and we might not hear something back for 3 months, 3 or 4 months. And all the time we're talking to broadcasters and they weren't having any of it. And we were pitching it as Death Row Diaries. And there might have been other titles at the time. And it wasn't getting picked up. And we changed the title to I'm a Killer as a sort of last ditch attempt. And I sent it out and I got a phone call literally the following day. And we started working with Netflix and A&E in the UK to bring the series together.
And Danny, you and Ned were both working on it from the very start, right?
Danny was. I came in a little bit later. So there'd already been about 6 months or so of right. letters being written, but I didn't come from a true crime background at all. So I hadn't done any crime programming of any sort.
Okay.
And it was kind of interesting sitting down with Danny and just kind of looking at the realities of it, of how it might fit. And one of the things which we came across was, I think we were going to tell these stories in quite a linear way. We would go and interview the killer, was what we thought, and then you would kind of intercut their story with other people as you went along. And then we quite quickly realized that in Texas, they would only let us talk to them for an hour. And an hour isn't long enough to to cover an interview to kind of get through the amount of material we needed. And also on top of that, we then realized that, well, once we've interviewed them for an hour, we're not allowed to interview them again for at least 3 months. So that's when we kind of came up with the idea of, well, let's have an interview of them at the beginning and an interview of them at the end, kind of bookmarking the bookending the entire film. So you hear their first interview, and that's their opportunity for them to speak about themselves, their crime, as the way they see it, largely uncontested. We don't kind of challenge them too much on that. That's their version. And then we went out and we looked at, say, everybody else who had been impacted by the crime or could give an insight to it, always people who had a direct connection to it. And once you've learned all of that, then that second interview is far, far more engaging and revealing and interesting. You might confront them, or you might want to really better understand something that they hadn't talked about before. So that kind of became the process. That's what, when I came on board, we started kind of working out those kind of practicalities of it.
So the vast majority of these episodes, they're based on 2-hour interviews separated by 3 months.
Yeah, largely. So in Texas, there are states where you can go back slightly sooner, but we found that it just worked. And that change in the way that they are, that you know, they have a lot to get off their chest. They haven't got a way of expressing themselves in prison normally. They might have been sitting there for 10, 15, 20, 30 years, building up this story of themselves and about who they are. So actually, once they've had a chance and they feel that they've managed to put that across to somebody, 3 months later down the line, they feel very relaxed and much more different, and you can really start to engage with them on slightly bigger things. They feel they've already said their piece, and it makes a big difference.
I think we've always seen it. Sorry, jump in, but the first interview is their interview, and the second interview is our interview. That they tell their story, and as Ned said, they could be rehearsing it, and most of the prisoners are engaged in various counselling sessions and all sorts of programs within the prison system, and so they've effectively rehearsed that story hundreds of times, and I think we get that version both in their letters and then in that first interview, and then the second interview, the skill of the directors involved in the series, and so in Ned, are two of the directors, is to then push them beyond their, not their comfort zone, but their sort of pre-rehearsed and the version of the story they're very comfortable with, to get probably a little bit closer to the truth. And we're very lucky that actually the vast majority, I think, of the 20 episodes we've filmed today, I think there has been a level of honesty and trust, and they have given us a version that is pretty close to truth, not in every case.
Mm-hmm. And so thinking about those two different interviews, the beginning and the end, is there, I mean, what is the difference from an interviewer, from a director's perspective? Is it, you know, you're going in and you're literally just listening to them on the first one, and you're just sitting and being a face for them to talk to? Or is it on the second one, you're the one asking the questions and being more forceful? How is that difference kind of manifest?
It is that. That is a pretty good summary of it. I would say the first interview, as Ned and Danny have said, they've come with a preconceived idea of what they want to talk about. Quite often they've got an agenda. They've got something that they, you know, almost like a bargaining chip that they come to the table with. I'll tell you my story, but you have to listen to me tell you about my experience with religion, or my experience with the justice system, or my experience numerous different things. But, you know, principally that first interview, they know and you know that you are there to listen to them fundamentally tell you what it means to say, I am a killer. That is the name of the show. That is what we're getting at. That's the experience we're exploring. What does that mean to them? Legally, ethically, practically, when they took somebody's life, what does I am a killer mean to them? The second interview, as Ned and Danny already mentioned, is far more of your classic sort of cross-questioning. What do they call it?
Cross-examination.
Cross-examination, there we go. So if you think of it in terms of a jury process, you've heard all the other perspectives from different people since you last heard from that person. And in order to tell that story responsibly, you're your job now is to go in and to sort of present them with the different perspectives and to pick up on holes that they might have glossed over or things that they might have twisted slightly and to interrogate that. Now, we see all kinds of responses to that. We see people deliberately trying to manipulate things, but we also see people who genuinely don't see the significance of certain points in their story that are actually to us and to our viewers massively significant. You know, just because they've glossed over something, it might not be maliciously. It may well be that they don't understand why anybody would want to know that.
I think for me that's always been a really interesting part. You kind of think you're going to hear them spin a version of events, which puts them in a positive light in their first thing, and then you go and talk to everyone else, and then you can, like Zoe says, cross-examine and kind of hold them to account on this. And so frequently you find that actually it's not that their first interview hasn't put them in a good light. And actually there are things which are in their background which they didn't mention or they didn't reference at all, which are seriously mitigating factors that will make you, it doesn't make them any less guilty, but it makes them more human and more understandable. I mean, a lot of them with the domestic abuse that they've received, which is a continuing factor with the murderers we talked to, they might not pay reference to it. They might not note it at all. And once you hear that, I think it's a lot easier to understand how they ended up in the place that they did.
But one of your films, Ned, I think is a really good example of that and kind of explains where that comes from. I think that, was it Joe Murphy that said, you know, I suffered these various abuses, like terrible beatings and physical abuse from his family, said, but no more than any other kids, I guess. So it's that kind of, for them, it's normal. So it's all about the frame of reference. They thought, well, every kid must grow up with this type of abuse. And that's sometimes why they don't mention it. And to us, they're hugely mitigating circumstances that obviously affect their outlook and their life and their ability to form relationships and everything else. But to them, it's like, well, everybody must suffer that form of abuse, mustn't they? And that's why I think sometimes why it doesn't come up.
Joey Murphy's one when he said that it was only when he was sentenced to death and then went to death row that he discovered that his life was not normal. That was the first inkling he had, and he was about 22 or something at that point.
And bear in mind, that story came into season two where we'd all, I mean, Zoe and Ned, much more so than me, had read thousands of these letters where there's descriptions of the sort of abuse on all levels, sexual, physical, mental abuse that some of these guys suffered. And Joey's, of all these letters we've read, stood out as the worst, and he didn't realise until the point he was sentenced to death that wasn't normal. It starts to give you a sense of the background. So it's very difficult, I think, for us to process that and understand. And not that it in any way excuses the act of murder or the violent crimes these guys committed, but it helps you understand where they could get to a place where life is perhaps less valuable.
And I think that for me, which having not come from a crime background, when I was first meeting with Danny about this series, why would I want to work on it, was that the focus was trying to better understand both the causes and the consequences of violent crime, of murder. And I thought that's the important part, and I think that's what we've always stuck to, is that in some way the films that we make, it doesn't mean that it excuses anybody at all, but you can understand how these people got to that place. And I think also then to understand what the consequences of their actions, the murder, on the victims' families, but also on their families and on them themselves. And I think I do think that I'm a Killer is a little different to quite a lot of true crime stuff, is in that's what our purpose is. Try and just understand a little bit more about how it happened and what the consequences are.
And what did you bring? So if you're coming from a different background than true crime, what did you bring to I'm a Killer that brought that kind of balance, told that story?
I think it was, I hadn't done had a true crime background, but I had been making quite a lot of network television documentaries, which have a kind of a fairly standard pace. They're broken up by parts, and you lead into a part. There's a slight cliffhanger. You know, there are conventions that you follow, and I think what we had in this one is that we didn't write any of these or structure any of them to have kind of part breaks. Those just came when they came. And we had to teach ourselves that we were going to slow this pace right down. I mean, in a fairly standard kind of network television documentary, you might have 5, 6, 7,000 editorial cuts in it. We were presenting films of the same length, which had maybe 1,500. We had a shot. I remember on the first episode,
Those would be the breaks in the you see between two scenes.
You just continual camera angle cuts, and the pace is very high. Our pace is very slow, deliberately slow, and we all, I think, editors, directors, all of us had to kind of fight against what we'd been used to doing for a long time. And we had one shot which lasted for 37 seconds, uncut, just continuous, and all you're hearing is somebody talking. And you're looking out the window of a car, and it helps you to process the words that they're saying. So I think, I mean, that wasn't solely down to me. Obviously, I'd love to say it was solely down to me, sure. And I was the genius behind
let's
that.
Say
but
it is.
But no, but I think that's it was. I hadn't had the conventions of crime, true crime television.
And I think that was intentional. I mean, Zoe had made some crime docs, but that wasn't your specialism. And most of the team were the same. We didn't really want to approach it as a true crime documentary. And the other thing we did very early on, we made the decision not to have any narration, which for us at the time, I mean, I've been working in documentaries for 20 years, and I hadn't made a documentary without a narration track up until this point. And it scared me to death when we all agreed. I happily agreed to do it in the room and was very nervous about it afterwards, because what the narrator gives you is a massive get-out-of-jail card as a filmmaker. You can move the story on, you can build all the signposts, you can answer the questions that your interviewees don't, and it's an extremely useful device. And to leave that off, and it was unusual at the time for a crime investigation show, a CNI show.
Yeah.
Was a big decision. It meant you had to... You know, our contributors had to tell the story.
Does that keep you honest?
It does. It makes you, but it makes the decision making process quite different. I mean, Zoe, what did you?
I think going back to your original question, that just because you haven't made crime documentaries in the past, as a documentary filmmaker, your lifeblood is telling human stories. Mm. It is about the peaks of life and the troughs of life and understanding humans and relating to humans. And actually coming to I'm a Killer was less a case of let's demonstrate our forensic understanding of the criminal process and more a case of what does this person say about what they've been through and what they've lived through and what can we learn from that? Especially when thrown into relief with others' experiences where they've been affected by the same incident. So I actually think not coming from a crime background was probably beneficial for the directors involved.
And so, Zoe, you came in a little bit later than both... Danny was right there from the beginning, a little bit later. So were you season two or...?
No, I was a director on series one.
Director on series
and
one.
And then series produced series two.
But you come in a little bit towards the actual production end of the set. So did you miss out on a lot of the correspondence?
Yeah, in fact, when I came to the first series, the original inmate interview with... I was doing two films and filming a third for Ned. The original inmate interviews with my two contributors had already been shot. Mm-hmm. So I came into a situation where the letters had been exchanged for months and months and months between these inmates. They'd agreed to an initial interview. That had been shot. And then as a director, I was told, what can you do with this? Where do you want to go with it?
Yeah.
Which facets of that story are you going to look into? Who else do you need to speak to? And that felt like an incredibly exciting prospect at the time.
Sure.
And started what became the next 4 years of documentary making.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So from your perspective, when you went in and you're taking on the second half, what kind of you've already mentioned looking at the letters, looking back on the letters and trying to pick apart some bits that they mentioned in the original letters, and then trying to kind of pick apart obviously the story that they're telling you that's been the story that they've been telling everybody for the maybe years and years. What other bits of media are you kind of showing to them, or what you know, is it quotes, is it pictures, is it bits of, is it interview footage? What are you kind of giving them?
Well, I imagine any journalist that approaches a story wants to see everything they can possibly get their hands on. So you're looking for the evidence box associated with the crime, any physical materials. You're also looking for any computerized exchanges relating to the incident. Beyond that, you're looking for crime scene footage, archive, family archive materials, videos from childhood, and any sort of family photographs that those associated with that individual can provide that will give you some insight into them as a human.
And are you presenting that to them?
To the inmate?
Yeah.
No.
Do you, what is there anything that you do present to them on that second interview that helps change the interview in some way?
Yeah, we did, didn't we?
Yeah, we decided. We brought in a technique of playing back extracts of some interviews to other interviewees, and quite often the best way of using that was to let the voices of the other people that we'd spoken to be played back to the inmate themselves. I mean, one of the parts of the structure is I'd done jury service a little bit before we were making the first series, and what I noticed with that is that you walk into a court and you hear a witness, and then you won't hear from them again, and then you hear the next witness, and it changes your perspective of what you've heard, and then a third one. And so we laid our films out very much like that. You hear testimony from each person along the way, and I think it works quite well as a conclusion to then remind viewers, remind ourselves of the kind of the what we think are the salient points, and get a reaction from those inmates once they hear the voice of somebody, especially if it directly contradicts something that they've said and somebody's got a very different take. You get a reaction and you get an insight to them, which I think is kind of helpful. But I think another part about our films is that we don't actually focus on the murder itself, the crime itself. In a lot of the films, we don't focus on it enormously because we know what happened roughly. They admit to those and they don't necessarily contest that. There's not a need to kind of go deeply into the crime, but it is a big need for us to understand it all. So we will go through every single document that we can. Our directors and our assistant producers will search through all the crime, all the court evidence, all the police evidence, everything else. And, you know, you could spend weeks and weeks doing it in order to actually bring down all of that information to just two lines of commentary on a card, which just comes up in that, because you have to understand it to be able to move the story on. But the story is often about the individuals, the people who've been left behind, the impact it's had on their life, or the journey that the inmate themselves is going on.
Sure. And thinking about that, what are the techniques that you would, or the any suggestions that you would give to interviewees, budding podcasters, either amateur or professional, some of whom might be here at CrimeCon today, that you would give to keep them honest and truthful when it comes to telling crime stories? Are there any kind of key things that you would kind of give them?
It's funny, we talked about this earlier, and I think the two things, just honesty and truthfulness. I think if you are honest and truthful in your intentions to your contributors, and you explain very clearly this is the story we're trying to tell, whether you have an agenda or not, but this is the story, this is the part that you play in that story, and that, you know, the message we want you to deliver, then I think you've taken several steps in the right direction, because these aren't our stories to tell. These are factual stories. You know, they're true events, and they involve real people. And I think we're trying to just to get to the bottom of it, what actually happened, and get as close as we can to the motivations of the people involved. Mm. I think we get most of the way there in most of the cases, and I think we do that by being very clear to the inmates, the killers, their family members, the families of the victims, saying this is the story we're going to tell. We want you to tell your part of that story, and we let them do it. Mm-hmm. And I think if you do that and you apply it to whatever type of documentary you're making, whether it's true crime or anything else, then you're definitely moving in the right direction.
I think I'd agree. I think it's about being an open book, and I think people respond to that. If they know that you don't have a hidden agenda, then they will respond to that. And I think you are then likely to get the most out of them. But I think the other part is to have faith in the material that you're gathering, that that's of interest. You don't need to sensationalize to make a story fascinating and engaging. I mean, I think sometimes, Zoe, I think we've had people mentioning to us, oh, you know, that you must have found that story with that amazing twist which happened that you didn't think was going to be part of this. We didn't know. The fact is that if you're looking at a human story and it involves somebody killing or somebody losing somebody that they've loved, the fact is that that is going to be, just on a human level, a really engaging story. And there are going to naturally be these twists and turns and things, because that's what human life is about. We don't look for those. We don't select cases on the basis that we are going to surprise an audience or with a narrative which they didn't expect. We try to tell the stories in the films which reflects the process of how we learnt about the story and the order that we learnt things and what has therefore engaged us.
I think it was a hugely different after making the first series, and obviously nobody had seen or heard of I Am a Killer. We're trying to explain people what our, you know, what our approach was and how the films would play. It was very different making the second series, because actually, you know, Zoe and Ed would be on the phone to potential contributors and say, yeah, we've seen it. We know exactly what you're trying to do. And most of them responded very positively to that. So it was, you know, I think the work spoke for itself.
I've got three top tips for budding interviewers, journos. Number one is preparation. When you are interviewing an inmate, you're going to have a very limited amount of time, an hour in Texas. You will literally get tapped on the shoulder and told you've got 10 minutes, 5 minutes, at which point you may only have got 10% through your questions. So preparation is 100% essential. You've got to know that case back to front so that when something comes in, when the inmate says something that is different to what you're expecting, you can respond to that and know that you're still getting a proper sense of the story that you need to obtain. That is the purpose, if you like, of your interview. The second thing, contrary to what Ned said,
about
being an open book, bound to kind of
is boundaries. Yes, you have to be an open book, but any good psychologist will tell you establishing what you are there to do, what you expect of them, and negotiating that, giving a little bit of yourself, but remembering you are there in a professional capacity. You don't want this to be about you. You want it to be about them. And yes, you have to accelerate that bond and get to know someone quickly, but boundaries are important for your sanity, if nothing else. Mm-hmm. So that's tip two. Tip three is listen, not speak all the time. She says speaking all the time. You have two ears versus one mouth for a reason, and there is always subtext to hear. If somebody is going on a big tangent about religion, why are they going on a big tangent about it? Listen to the framing of their answers. Are they telling you that because they want you to think that they're a good person who has morals? What's that telling you about the crime itself? Was there any subtext that they're trying to convey to you? So I would say, you know, there's a million things that can go wrong, but those are my three top tips.
And thinking, I guess, still about...
That was much better than our answer, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say.
She really showed us up there, Danny.
We did it in the wrong order there, really, to be honest.
You can cut me and Danny out.
Yeah, I'll put it in the other order. So thinking about the kind of like the podcast landscape, going back to, you know, the framing of the original, the question there, the new media landscape, podcasts, you know, audiobooks, it's obviously a very different and divergent field. It's incredibly, like, it's spreading the reach of true crime massively. How does that kind of sit with you guys as mainly TV broadcasters? And, you know, are you doing different things?
Funny you should say that. No, I think firstly that the podcast, the true crime podcast field is fascinating because the stories do work so well in audio form. And obviously it's incredibly popular, and we've got we've been working with Podomo on a series called Letters from a Killer, which makes use of those thousands of letters we talked about earlier. There's a whole raft of them that we haven't, for various reasons, been able to film, whether it's access issues with certain states that don't allow cameras into maximum security prisons, or well, a whole raft of issues. And but they're brilliant, brilliant stories, and the letters are really compelling, and stories that we've sat and told over endlessly. How are we going to tell these? How can we bring them to an audience? We're not allowed to film them. And podcasting has given us the opportunity, and Letters from a Killer has given us the opportunity to tell those stories that we wouldn't otherwise able to bring to an audience. And so, you know, that those years of research and the piles of letters have now got an outlet, and it's been brilliant for us, and to be able to revisit cases that are on our almost our wish list of stories to tell. And so that's it's been a fantastic opportunity.
And to put in a second plug, so yes, there is the podcast Letters from a Killer, which is obviously available, but the book Macmillan are publishing, an I'm a Killer book, in February of next year, of 2022. And that's looking at 10 of the cases, of the 20 cases that we've already covered. But I think what's interesting in your question is about those different media formats. And they are, we're looking at similar stories. It's this, you know, it's from the same research work that we've done, but these different formats allow for something very different. We found that the book, we think, really complements the films that we've made. Mm-hmm. Those films are constrained by the duration that you can have and the pacing that you allow. You can have an awful lot more information in a book, but in a book you don't get to be visually in those places. So they provide a very different function. I think they complement each other. And I think the same happens with the podcast. The podcast, you can get more, you know, the podcast, Zoe and I talking, we can put forward an opinion that we have about something, or the way that we, a particular letter might make us individually feel, or how we might view a killer at that stage of reading a letter. We deliberately don't do that in our films because we think it's really important for the viewer to be left to, we provide the viewer with everything that they need to make their own assessment and their own judgment. So I think these different medias, I think, work really well for exploring sometimes the same stories, sometimes just similar stories. I think there's a place for all of them, and I think they complement each other.
I think we might have time to squeeze out a couple of questions. I've got one question right at the front here, so I'm going to pass you the mic over.
I actually have two questions, if you have time to answer them. The first one is, for someone who's interested in true crime, with or without a background in crime, how do they go about working on a documentary like I Am a Killer? And my second question is, if there are cases that really impacted you and stood out to you, what made them stand out?
You can do the first one.
I think it's... No, you can definitely do the first bit. This is your area.
Well, for a start, most people don't walk into making documentaries like I'm a Killer. I worked in daytime television making films about washing machines and mortgages for at least 4 or 5 years at the start of my career. Formal education is great, but you don't need to go down that route. If you are interested in the stories and interested in the journalism, especially with avenues like podcasting, blogging, you know, there are so many places where you can start writing, start engaging with the people that are in these professions and communicating with them. If you've got ideas, you can write to production companies and tell them about them, you know, get on the radar. You're looking at research roles, and there are many, many schemes out there now, far more than there were 10 years ago, which use words like access. We want to bring different perspectives into this industry. So it's just a question of looking out for those avenues. And you know, if you're interested, start making the content. Make it yourself, because with you, there's a democratization of media now. There's YouTube, there's TikTok. You know, you can do journalism in so many new, exciting ways.
I think also the projects like ours, like I'm a Killer, if that's the sort of thing you're particularly interested in, are extremely research heavy, and they have certainly in our company, a large base of researchers at various stages in their careers and their experiences. So targeting production companies that are making the sorts of shows you like, and putting yourself forward. We certainly aren't looking, when we're recruiting, for people that have made shows like I'm a Killer. But that people that demonstrate, you know, excellent research skills and written skills and you know, the sort of level of maturity that we'd expect. But, I mean, true crime experience is very far down our list of attributes, isn't it, when we're looking to recruit? Because as these guys said, they hadn't done it either. And the second question was, which stories stick out and what and why?
Why specifically makes them stick out to you?
Yeah, I think we've all got probably got different ones. I think we've read thousands of letters, these guys more than me, but they are, some of them are shocking and awful and upsetting. And it's generally the ones that stick out where some of the character comes through in the letter writing. You get a sense of who that person is that's writing to you. Because they do, it's not that I don't think any of us that have been doing it have become blasé or immune to what we're reading. But every now and then somebody's personality comes out. You read something that feels like they're telling the truth, and it's a little bit surprising and it catches your eye. And I think it's those ones that we rise to the top of the pile, and that one of these guys or Jason, who Jason Oates is our head of development that's been running this, you know, wrote the very first letter 4 or 5 years ago. And when he reads a letter like that, you know, somebody will stand up and say, here's one. You know, and it's usually because you get a real sense of who that person is that's writing to you. So I think that's what generally catches the eye.
And one final question.
So out of all of the 20 cases that you did, which one was the scariest to interview?
I was very lucky. I've not had to interview anyone scary. But I do, James Robertson, who was the first inmate in the first series of films, who kind of looks like he's come out of central casting for kind of a psychopathic killer. He's big, he's got a shaved head, he leers, he's got missing teeth. And he was in Florida, and I do know that Ross and Stu, who were the director and the producer who went to interview with him, were surprised to suddenly find that they didn't have a room with glass or separation. So he was sat on a chair right in front of them, shackled, and that kind of gave them some confidence, some reassurance that he was shackled, apart from when they left. And I think Stu mentioned to the guard, he said, oh, thank goodness he was shackled, because it got a bit scary a couple of times. He says, oh, with James, that wouldn't have made any difference. And it's like, oh, I'm glad I know that now, at the end of that thing, but we have got to go back in a couple of months.
This is a guy that had killed one of his cellmates in prison to get on death row. So his violence...
Armed with nothing but a sock. So, yeah. I mean...
His violence hadn't stopped when he arrived at prison. It actually got worse. So he's probably the most physically intimidating, or as it happened, I don't think would have hurt a fly at that stage in his career. But you've met a couple of interesting...
Lovely gentlemen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing like that, though. I mean, Charles Thompson in series one, he is... as I said earlier, the consummate narcissist. We finished his interview and I finished his interview and he beckoned me to the glass and asked me to pick up the telephone. And he said, if you show what you have just told me that you're going to include in this program, you personally are signing my death warrant. And he is a scary person. He is through the glass. But that fear that came then was a different kind of fear. That was a kind of, are we doing the right thing? Is that true? You know it's not. Your common sense, I didn't shoot two people dead. He did. He put himself there. He should have known that we would have found the evidence that we did find, which had been shown in open court and then retracted, yada, yada, yada. The point is, there are... unexpectedly scary moments, and you know, I've never had an experience like Ross and Stu with somebody luckily shackled.
I've been more scared by some of the additional contributors that we've interviewed. I just think about filming in small unusual rural towns in across the US and ending up in kind of going, oh, I don't want to stay here. this camera on our shoulder looks very expensive and seems to be drawing attention. I'd like to kind of go somewhere else for a bit. I think that's more scary than the prisoners often.
Well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for. My thanks to Danny Tipping, Ned Parker and Zoe Hines for joining us at CrimeCon today, and for all you guys as well. For more podcasts and videos of interviews and sessions from CrimeCon, search for and subscribe to Crime Investigation on YouTube. And if you haven't already, you can catch up on both seasons of I Am a Killer on Crime and Investigation. All you need to do is search on your whatever provider you're on, or search for our collection of podcast series wherever you listen, and stream many of our other excellent TV shows through Crime Investigation Play. Thank you very much.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.